It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. and Germany have both agreed to supply the Ukrainian military with top-of-the-line tanks after weeks of wrangling. We'll check out the decision and what it could mean. First, in his State of the State address last night, Governor Tony Evers highlighted his priorities for education funding here in Wisconsin.
Doing what's best for our kids has always been what's best for our state, and today we can afford to do more. So I'm going to deliver on the promise I made before the election to use a portion of our state's historic surplus to make an historic investment in our kids and in our schools.
As we get rolling in the state's budget season, Evers announced he would seek additional money for expanded mental health services for students, a boost in reading education, and in general, a substantial boost in state funding for local districts. Republican lawmakers have signaled and repeated last night that they'd like to see an expansion of school choice and voucher programs in the state, possibly even some version of universal school choice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of what the governor and what the Republican response from Robin Voss had to say about education funding in the state? Do you want more money going to public schools? Are there particular areas of need that you see if you work in a local district? What do you see as your main budget challenges? Then ideas for expanding school choice, expanding school vouchers. Should everyone in the state have the same access to the vouchers, or should there be income limits as there are now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marguerite Pienaar-Parks is professor of leadership, literacy, and social foundations at the UW-Oshkosh College of Education and Human Services. Marguerite, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for having me.
All right, with an asterisk at everything we're about to talk about, we don't have a lot of specific budget details from the governor or from Republicans. They're talking in broad strokes so far. All that said, let's start with public schools. What do you see as areas in public schools that could maybe use a boost in funding?
Well, when I looked at what Governor Evers was talking about yesterday, I think one of the ones that he talked about is retaining our teachers. It's critical that our teachers be paid a fair wage, that they want to stay. And it's not just important for the teachers. It's also important for the students, because when they see the same teachers in the building year after year, that also gives them a feeling of stability in the school building. So I think that one of the things he said he was going to fund, retaining teachers, is a really critical funding.
Looking at some of the other areas he brought up, we heard mental health funding would be a priority, $500 million overall for mental health and behavioral services. Are you seeing a need for that in our schools?
We've always seen a need for that. When we started doing cuts, we start cutting some of the things that students need the most to help with their mental health. One of the things we know is there are not nearly enough counselors or social workers in the buildings with which to support the students. Mental health challenges are going through the roof in all age groups. I was just listening today about how the number of people who are calling the suicide line in Wisconsin has almost doubled with the new numbers. So it's the parents who need mental health, it's the students who need mental health, it's the educators. I mean, in today's society, it is going up, so yes, we definitely need more support, more educators who are well-educated in issues of social-emotional learning, are well-educated in trauma-informed care, so that they are making any decisions they make based on knowledge versus based on intuition.
And then $20 million for improving reading skills. I know there have been concerns with our standardized tests when it comes to reading before COVID, definitely since COVID started, and the concerns about the impact of remote learning. Are there strategies you'd like to see tackled to try to at least catch up with some of the reading skills we might have lost?
For those of you who've never taught reading, and I'm a high school teacher, by the way, but I spent 5 semesters team teaching with one of the best reading specialists in the state, Dr. Michael Ford, and discovered how incredibly difficult teaching reading is, because every student has a different issue. Is it the blends? Is it the phonemes? You know, is it the consonant blends, the vowel blends? And teachers don't have the time, time's a big one, to sit down and individually be able to assess each child to the level that would really be helpful. So yes, any help that can be given to teachers with which so that they can once again individualize the reading needs of students, especially in younger levels, is critical. We also know that we tend to lose our readers from second to third grade because of the transition from picture books to chapter books. And we also know that we tend to lose our readers really when they go into middle school. So it's really critical that we take a look not just at the early development ages, but at other times when we're losing our readers.
We're talking to Marguerite Pinnock-Parks from UW Oshkosh's College of Education and Human Services, looking at budget priorities from Governor Evers in his State of the State address last night, the Republican response from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. I want to give a listen to Speaker Voss now talking about school choice. Republicans in the legislature hoping to see some sort of expansion instead of, or maybe in addition to, increases in public school funding. Here's a listen to some of what Speaker Voss had to say.
While my Democratic colleagues want to make the issue about public versus private schools, school choice isn't just about kids leaving a public school to go to a private one. In fact, in the 2021-22 school year, 71,489 kids open enrolled, leaving one public school to choose a different public school. You see, it's all about parents picking the best school for their children, not being trapped in the one where they happen to live, whether or not it's the right fit for their son or daughter.
Marguerite, before we get into pros and cons of school choice, can you talk about the variety within school choice? When we say that phrase, it can cover a lot of ground, from a public charter to public, going to the public school, a town over, to private schools, to voucher schools. There's a lot contained in that phrase, right?
Yes, there is. I was writing it down and listening. And I think that is one of the biggest misunderstandings when we talk about school choice. Because it can be, you choose to enroll your child in the school in the district next door because of their athletic program, because of their music program, because of their reading scores. That's one type. Charter schools are public schools. They tend to have to follow all of the public rules, with the exception of ones that they've written in to their governance policy. But for the most part, you know, they're public teachers with public school licenses. And then private schools, of course, run on a whole different list. And that's really where the vouchers come in, is the idea that, and it is a lot about, Representative Voss was wrong when he says it's not just about one kid going to another, because it's also incredibly important about the funding that you take away from one school to give to another school. And that's where one of the critical issues of going from public to private is as Dr. Evers said, as Governor Evers said, we need to put money into our public schools, not take it away. And vouchers take it away from the students who are still at that school there.
And one idea, Assembly Speaker Voss, one of the biggest proponents of doing something along the lines of a universal school choice. Again, that can cover a lot of ground in different details. But one basic idea is saying, okay, we have an income limit in the state's voucher programs, plural, Milwaukee, Racine, and then the statewide one. The idea of saying, okay, no more income limit. Any parent can take advantage of that voucher program, use it at a private, religious, whatever school in their community. What are your thoughts on the specific idea of changing, removing that income limit on the use of vouchers?
Throughout my history as an education professor and as an educator who worked in what we would call an urban school, I'm always looking at issues of equity. And what happens with the voucher program, which some people say is about equality, not equity, is this idea that there are people, parents, who will put their children into voucher schools even though they could pay the tuition, which once again would take a space away from a child who can't. But then you also have to look at who knows how to navigate the voucher program, who has the education, the skills, the knowledge, the friends, the educators, who can tell them how to navigate it, because it's not that simple to just say, I want to put my child into this school. And there are a lot of things you have to know. There's lots of hoops you have to jump through. There's lots of paperwork you have to do. And that takes the equity out of it, because that means the people who are able to navigate the system are going to be the ones whose kids get in. And that's not equitable.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lauren joins us now in Janesville. Lauren, hi.
Hi. I'm a mental health counselor. I handle adults primarily, but and I work for a federally qualified clinic in Beloit. The family issues that I deal with, I know, are trickling down to our kids. Our kids are in a world of hurt. They need mental health care. They need social workers there to help them and families, navigate systems, etc. The more investment that we do in their mental health while they are still growing and developing, will turn them into adults that are, I'm trying to think of the word here, but they will be secure within themselves. They will be mentally stable, et cetera, that are able to handle jobs and pressures of life, et cetera. What I would like to see happen with part of that money, not just straight funding to go to clinics, et cetera, but there is such a shortage. Nobody wants to go into this profession. And there aren't enough therapists, even the ones that just graduate, there are not enough social workers and graduates to go around. We really need to partner with the schools. We really need to make a push for some sort of incentive for folks that have the ability to do this type of work.
Lauren, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Marguerite?
Oh, I completely agree with her. One of the things that I've always said, that if I could create my ideal teacher education program, because that's what I teach in, every person who's going to be a teacher would have to take a course in counseling. And that currently is not a requirement, but teachers spend an enormous amount of time counseling students who are having mental health issues or, have just had a bad day. I had a parent when I was teaching high school who found his son skipping school. So he literally threw the kid into my classroom. I mean, literally, back of the neck, feet. And how is that kid supposed to be able to learn when that happens? And as a first-year teacher, which I was not prepared to help him. Every teacher needs a course in counseling because, as Sarah said, there's just not enough. I'm sorry, as the caller said, there's just certainly is not enough.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Marguerite Pienick-Parks, Professor of Leadership, Literacy, and Social Foundations at the UW Oshkosh College of Education and Human Services, talking about state funding for public education and for school choice programs. Governor Evers highlighted his proposals for a boost in public school funding last night in a State of the State speech. Republican lawmakers say they want to expand the school choice system in various ways in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with the state's current budget surplus. When it comes to education, where would you want money to go? Public schools, if so, are there particular things you think we need to do? School choice programs, expand, contract, stay where we are, take off income limits on the voucher program? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about school funding and school choice with UW Oshkosh Education Professor Marguerite Pienick-Parks. You can join in with your thoughts, what you want to see happen in this year's state budget, this two-year state budget, when it comes to funding of public schools, various kinds of choice programs in the state. Call 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls now. Sarah is with us in Madison. Sarah, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Sarah?
I'm a retired public school teacher and feel very strongly that funding should go to our public schools. It's the great equalizer. Everybody can get a wonderful education. And I just wonder when the last time any of our Republican legislators have ever been in a public school. Of all the governors that we've had, Evers would be the most knowledgeable about public schools, having been a public school superintendent and an educator. These vouchers only privatize, really, public education. And I know about charter schools, and they're publicly funded, but they do not operate on the same scale as what we call regular public schools. I feel very strongly about Republicans destroying public education in our state and in our country.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Marguerite, there's a concern from Republicans, and not just Republicans, that some public schools aren't doing the job as well as they could be, and something needs to change. What do you think?
One of the things that I talk to my students about, and this would be a class as people prepare to be principals, is that one of the issues with American public schools historically, and you can go back through history, is that every time we change parties in power, we change the ideology of education. And that's because the different parties have different ideologies. I always tell my students, it's not that one is better than the other, it's just that they both have different ideas on how to make our educational program the best we can. But the problem is that we never stay on one track long enough to get something accomplished. So we will implement No Child Left Behind, and 8 years later we do something else. And then we'll implement like all the stuff that came out of Nation at Risk, and then we do something else. When you look at the education of Finland, which by the way has no standardized test, and their teachers are one of the highest paid professions and one of the highest trained professions, they set a goal years ago of what they wanted their schools to look like, and they kept on the same track. I really think that's important, because as long as we continue to change from ideology to ideology, then how can we get? Education needs to be in the middle, but we can't get in the middle because we continuously swing to extremes one way or the other. So to answer the question, it's, we need to find a way to that old adage of, instead of seeing why we have all the fish in the pond, why don't we go up to the front of the river to see who's drawing them in or what's drawing them in? Why aren't we going to see that as opposed to trying to just, oh, let's do this, oh, let's do that, oh, let's do this, oh, let's do that, without really looking at what the educational needs are?
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Louise now in Dodgeville. Louise, hello.
Hi. I live in Southwest Wisconsin and am able to listen to Iowa Public Radio along with Wisconsin Public Radio. But I was very shocked, and not shocked, that Governor Kim Reynolds, who's a Republican, and Iowa has a Republican House and Senate, they just passed a big bill to privatize basically education. So I'm wondering, one state over, what the impact is going to be on Wisconsin. Has Iowa passed all this?
Louise, thanks for the call. I don't know if it's passed completely. I know Iowa is advancing something comparable to that universal school choice, a scholarship available to anyone using private schools, as I vaguely understand it. Marguerite, are you watching Iowa or other states?
I wish I was. I'm from Iowa. Actually, my PhD is from University of Iowa, and I went to school there. Once again, when you start, I'm going to go back to the caller a minute ago, Sarah from Madison. When you try to privatize schools, that means you don't know what goes on in schools. I would love to see any of these people who are trying to prioritize schools to go into a public school and teach for a week, do all the prep and all of that. Education was not meant to be privatized. The very first law that required education in this country The old Deluder Satan law in Massachusetts was established so that everybody in that community could get a fair and equal education so that they could become members of the United States and voting and educated members. To privatize takes away what our whole entire educational system in the United States has always been based on.
Louise, thanks for that call. And Louise is quite right. Iowa did sign, the governor of Iowa signed that into law just yesterday, it looks like. In just our last minute or so, Marguerite, what are you watching for as the budget negotiations go forward here?
I'm looking to see that Governor Evers is able to do what he wants to do for education. I'm also the bridges and the roads and all of that. But with education, we've got so many phenomenal teachers out there and administrators and superintendents and so many students who so deserve everything we can give them. And that's not just money, but the money creates opportunities. And we don't want to take those opportunities away from any of our students, but especially the students who are the most in need. So I'm looking forward to Governor Evers and his budget and the legislature creating most opportunities to create equitable access for all of our students in the state of Wisconsin so that we continue to be a great state.
Marguerite, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marguerite Bienick-Parks is a professor of leadership, literacy, and social foundations at the UW-Oshkosh School of Education and Human Services. We talked to her today about Governor Evers' proposals for increasing public school funding and Republican state lawmakers' goals to expand the school choice system here in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll get the latest updates from the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the announcement that the U.S. and Germany will send tanks to the Ukrainian military. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our society places a value on our height, but we'll talk to a writer who makes the case that there's never been a better time to be short. Now, the U.S. announced it would send 31 M1 Abrams tanks overseas to help Ukraine in its fight against Russia. President Biden talked about the tanks earlier today.
We'll begin to train the Ukrainian troops on these issues of sustainment, logistics, and maintenance as soon as possible. I'm grateful to Chancellor Schultz for providing German Leopard 2 tanks, and will lead an effort to organize a European contribution of two tank battalions for Ukraine. I want to thank the Chancellor for his leadership and his steadfast commitment to our collective efforts to support Ukraine. Germany has really stepped up.
As Biden said, Germany will also send over tanks supporting Ukraine with 14 Leopard 2 tanks, and Germany will allow other nations to send their inventory of the German-made tanks to Ukraine, as Poland has already said it will do. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. sending these tanks to Ukraine and more generally U.S. and European support for the Ukrainian resistance to the Russian invasion? Do you have questions about the latest there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
This story turned over the last day and a half or so. When we first called you, it seemed like an open question of whether these tanks, German and American, would be going to Ukraine. What was the stumbling block? Why was this such a big open question given past military support for Ukraine?
Yeah, well, last Friday, there was a meeting of NATO and NATO partnered countries, and this was a big issue, a big contentious debate, and Germany really was the stumbling block because Germany supplies its Leopard tanks to other European countries, including Poland. Those countries wanted to send them to Ukraine, and Germany was suggesting that it wouldn't allow that, and it didn't suggest that it was going to change its mind very quickly on Friday, but the U.S. pressure seems to have been a key a key reason, I think, for why Germany changed its mind. And I think the decision by the United States is in part to gain cooperation from Germany.
One of the big questions with all kinds of military hardware over the last year or so has been, is this crossing a line that's going to provoke a strong reaction from Russia and from Putin, targeting not just Ukraine, but something beyond that? What do you think it took to overcome that concern?
Well, I think that this has been maybe one of the guiding questions of the war, is where is the line? What does it mean to, how can we avoid a direct NATO or US-Russia confrontation? And so each of these moments where there's a decision about sending weapons has kind of addressed that. Is this going too far? And I think the Russian response by now is somewhat predictable, which is that they say whatever weaponry is going to be sent won't make a difference, it won't work, and also the Ukrainian people will pay a price. But they've been making Ukrainian people pay a price with the bombing of civilian targets and apartment buildings, et cetera, regardless of the weaponry that's been sent. So I think that at this point, the nuclear threat and the threat of escalation to civilians, they've already crossed that bridge. And so I don't think that's effective anymore. And that's probably changed some minds in the West about what we can do for Ukraine.
With the American Abrams tanks, it's going to be a while to get the hardware there, get people trained on them. The Leopard 2 tanks are also going to take, they're a little closer at hand, still take a while to get there. Do you see an immediate symbolic value for Ukraine with this commitment?
Oh, yes. I think symbolically it's really important because it was a test of European and NATO unity. And there was, you know, unfortunately, disagreement that was on display last week. But the resolution of this shows that the United States and Europe is united in supporting Ukraine. So I think the Abrams tanks aren't probably going to be there for 6 to 8 months at least, is what I've seen estimates of. But still, it's an important commitment to say that the U.S. is supporting Ukraine as well as other countries. I mean, Germany is a very, very key player in the alliance supporting Ukraine. And so I think the agreement by Germany eventually, finally, is important, even though it took a while to get there.
During Biden's speech today, he commented on at least Russian express concerns that this was an offense to Russia and raised the risk of offensive action to Russia with these tanks being in place in Ukraine. Here's another listen to President Biden.
There is no offensive threat to Russia. If Russia troops return to Russia, they'll be there where they belong. This war would be over today.
Now, I think a pro-Russian argument would be that Crimea is part of Russia now, that key eastern parts of Ukraine are part of Russia. Their claim is that they're defending their territory. I don't think that's recognized by pretty much anyone in the global community. How big a threat are these to the Russian occupation of parts of Ukraine?
Well, I think the hope is that in response to an expected renewed Russian assault in the spring, that these tanks are going to allow Ukraine to defend itself and to defend its territory. I mean, as you said, nobody outside of Russia really accepts the annexations or accepts that Russia, that the territory that they're fighting on is Russia. I think it's clear to most people that Russia invaded Ukraine. They're fighting on the territory of Ukraine, and Ukraine is trying to protect and regain its own territory. So I think President Biden is correct that Putin has the ability to end this war immediately by withdrawing Russian troops back into Russia, and that none of this hardware, none of this military support poses any threat to Russia per se, but rather it's aimed at supporting Ukraine and Ukraine's existential struggle to preserve its nationhood and statehood.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison, looking at the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the decision now by the U.S. and Germany to supply key battle tanks to the Ukrainian military. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have very strong this. I think this is a ball of tangled haywire. I think it's a no-win situation, and escalating military weaponry only escalates the conflict. I don't defend what Putin is doing. I think he's held in power by the oligarchs. If Putin pulls out of Ukraine, he will lose power in Russia. Ukraine is corrupt. I think that's proven by the change of administrators they had in their government recently. I firmly believe, this is my opinion, that Ukraine belongs to Russia. It has been for centuries. And I think Zelensky should surrender. I know it's not popular, but that's my opinion. We should be negotiating peace instead of escalating war.
Jeff, thanks for the call. I think many people in Ukraine would disagree with the assessment that Ukraine belongs to Russia. But that's one of the key issues at stake here, Yoshiko.
Yeah, I think that one of the problems with the idea of Ukraine surrendering in order to get peace is that we've actually seen what has happened in Russian-controlled territory. And what's happened there is not peace. We see brutality and human rights abuses, some would argue rising to the level of genocide. And so for Ukraine to withdraw its military would mean to subject the people who are living in those occupied territories to this terror of the Russian state. And I think that's a real problem with the argument that Ukraine can just give up the territory and that will lead to peace. Unfortunately, Russia is not interested in peace, even in the territories that it's occupying.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Jeff also referring to another piece of news there. President Zelensky, removed or encouraged the removal from office of some local administrators accused of corruption in Ukraine. Is that something you have your eye on, Yoshiko?
Yes, that's a big story. And potentially there could be more shakeups or changes in Zelensky's cabinet. So I do want to acknowledge that corruption is something that Ukraine has struggled with in the past. It's one of the reasons for the two successful social revolutions and turnovers in government in the past that people were profoundly disappointed in their governments and fed up with the corruption. So corruption has been an issue that Zelensky has been working on. But it's kind of an interesting question to think about. What does it mean to fire somebody on the basis of corruption allegations? Does that mean that's a signal that the country is corrupt? Or does that mean it's a signal that the government is doing something about it? So Zelensky is definitely suggesting it's the latter, that yes, there are some problems and he's addressing them. So I guess you can look at it different ways.
And when I see, Yoshiko, measures of corruption in nations around the world, Ukraine ranks pretty high in terms of corruption. Worse still, though, is Russia. And so on a global scale, we're choosing in some cases between a corrupt, very corrupt authoritarian regime in Russia or a fairly corrupt but still roughly democratic regime in Ukraine. Am I oversimplifying there?
I think that it's correct that Russia ranks worse on international indices than Ukraine in corruption. But I think the important thing is that Ukraine has changed very much since 2019, since the election of Zelensky. And those indices take a bit of time to catch up. And just when we might have expected additional surveys or rounds of research to assess the situation, just a couple of years after Zelensky's presidency, Russia has invaded. And so there isn't a lot of, it's not easy at this point to assess the level of corruption in a wartime state. So I think that there are many signs that suggest Zelensky's taking corruption seriously and trying to do something about it. But I don't think at this point it's very easy for either Russia or Ukraine to assess the level of corruption because both countries are relatively difficult to access in terms of social science research at this point.
We're talking to Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the U.S. and Germany announcing they'll send some key tanks to Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. involvement with the war in Ukraine? Do you want to see more support, less support, military aid, financial aid, you name it? Call in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the war in Ukraine, the U.S. announcement of the sending of military tanks to Ukraine, Germany also joining in on that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on U.S. support for Ukraine, your questions about what's going on there. 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls now. Tim is with us in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. To the caller earlier, for one, Ukraine's never been part of Russia, although Russia's tried to take it over the centuries and have done some obscenely cruel things to those people. Two, France helped us and fight for independence, and they went broke doing it. And if they had not done it, we would not be America. And the English certainly said a lot of bad things about us, so just comment.
Tim, thanks for the call. Yoshiko, Tim, getting to some fundamental questions here. What obligations, if any, does the U.S. have to help a country in a situation like Ukraine's?
Yeah, I think that it's becoming increasingly clear that Russia didn't just invade a country. Russia is attempting to change the European security infrastructure and really the global world order. I think that that's why many people see this not just as a matter of defending Ukraine, but of standing up for really civilization and democracy and norms of democracy and norms of human rights. To let Russia behave the way it's been in terms of the atrocities, the civilian bombing, etc., is really to step back from a lot of values that Americans have been fighting for over the years. So I think that there's many people that see it as both an obligation to support Ukraine against an aggressive neighbor, but also to just stand up for what's right in the world. And I think that latter argument is gaining steam the worse the Russian behavior has been as the war has dragged on.
Tim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. The question of how this all ends, Yoshiko, the idea, and we've talked about this a little already, that Ukraine would give up parts of its territory and expose the people in those territories to what would happen under Russian rule, seems to be off the table largely. What would have to happen in Russia for them to pull back this invasion?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, both sides are committed to fighting at this point. Unfortunately, on the Russian side, no matter how bad the army, its army has performed, no matter how bad the situation, they seem to have doubled down and are more committed to continuing the fight. Unfortunately, it looks like Russia is, you know, fortifying this line of conflict of more than 600 miles, and they are really digging in and planning for renewed assault in the spring. And that's one of the reasons why the additional weaponry and high-tech weaponry and the tanks in particular are important to Ukraine. But I think a number of analysts don't see a quick end to this. But it doesn't look to me like Russia is going to accept they're not going to voluntarily withdraw or just sort of change their mind. They're going to have to be defeated militarily or pushed back militarily. And that's why the support for Ukraine at this point, the military support for Ukraine has become so important. It's possible if there was something radical in Russia, such as somehow if Putin were to die or something like that, that could bring about a change in policy. But the prospects for a coup or Putin stepping down, I think, are remote. basically zero. I don't see any way that Putin is going to step down.
To the extent we gauge public opinion in Russia, it seems like, at least what we see here in the United States, most of the criticism of the war, the Russian war in Ukraine, isn't that it happened in the first place, but that it was mismanaged or run ineffectively. In effect, absent Putin, we might get a replacement that is even more militaristic in some ways. Is that a concern you have?
Not really. I think that Putin is basically behaving as badly as you can imagine. He's ruined Russia as a country for decades to come. He's ruined the economy. He's made it, he's isolated it internationally, and he's caused all this death and destruction in Ukraine. So I think when people worry about somebody worse than Putin, you think, what exactly would be worse? I think he's pretty far up there in terms of worst regimes, not only for Ukraine, but for Russia as well. But it's correct that a lot of the criticism is oriented towards criticism of how the war is being fought rather than criticism of the war itself. However, I think we have to always remember that Putin is illegitimate and he's not gained any supporters during this war. There were already a lot of people who were not supportive of him before the war, and those people are absolutely silenced and marginalized. So it's hard to know the true level of support within the country, because the only people really able to speak are people who are already regime supporters.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, political scientist looking at the latest news in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko, I think something nagging on the minds of people around the world is, if Putin feels like conventional military victory is out of reach, if his troops are getting pushed back toward Russian borders, is there a situation where he resorts to nuclear weapons, locally at a tactical level or more? What do you watch for?
Yeah, this is a concern, and I think this has been a guiding concern of NATO's action and the United States' reaction to the war to avoid nuclear confrontation and avoid a direct NATO confrontation with Russia at all costs. I think what people look for, though, because of the number of times that this has kind of come up and Russia has raised this flag, is they look for actual movement of nuclear weapons and delivery vehicles to see, has anything actually changed in Russia's nuclear stance? Are they actually getting ready for some kind of nuclear attack? And whereas there were some indications at various points in the war that maybe this was more of a possibility, I think that there's been a lot of pulling back from that nuclear rhetoric. And even in this case with the tanks, they haven't directly threatened nuclear retaliation. They've said, Dmitry Peskov, the press secretary, said, well, these tanks won't work, won't be helpful, and Ukrainian people will suffer. So I think that that's an indication that they aren't actually actively focused on the nuclear response at this point. But it remains a concern, because it's a regime that is not committed to any kind of humanity or human rights or norms of decency. So it remains a concern.
In just our last minute or so, Yoshiko, what are you watching for in the next couple of months?
Well, I think that it seems like we need to understand what ways the Ukrainians might be able to break through this line and make some additional progress. I'm sure that's what they're working on. On the Russian side, there's been a lot of turnover in military command. There's remains a ton of corruption. And so it's possible that despite their efforts to improve their performance, they won't be able to. So I think that people are going to be watching the performance on the Russian side and looking for options for the Ukrainian side, but also ways to make use of this additional new weaponry.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Yoshiko Herrera, political science professor at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about the U.S. decision to send tanks to Ukraine in that country's fight against Russia. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, you may have seen headlines and stories about machine learning, artificial intelligence, and chatbots that can write stuff that sounds maybe like it was written by a human. Well, there's a lot behind that. We're going to find out how those technologies work, what they can and can't do, and maybe answer your unanswered questions. If you have a question, email ideas@WPR.org. Then listen in tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. We are proud of our state parks in Wisconsin with good reason, and now one of them is getting some national recognition. A website called Travel Lens analyzed social media, online reviews, and more to rate state parks around the country. One category was most shared on Instagram. A Wisconsin state park came in 5th in the country among all state parks. Which Wisconsin park? The answer may shock you. Okay, not really. It was Devil's Lake, Wisconsin's most popular, most visited state park. Devil's Lake also shows up at number 14 among the most beautiful state parks in the country, at least according to online reviews. Number one on that list, by the way, just across the border, Porcupine Mountain State Park in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. By the way, the number one most Instagrammed state park was some sideshow in New York called Niagara Falls State Park. What? What are people taking pictures of there? No clue. This is Central Time.